You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 25th of July, 2017, on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to The Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Coming up in the programme...
I am disappointed in the Attorney General. He should not have recused himself. I think that's a bad thing, not for the president, but for the presidency. I think it's unfair to the presidency.
Donald Trump using the power of the presidency to bully his own Attorney General. We'll ask why another of his friends has suddenly fallen from favor. And later we'll have a guide to the endless stories from Washington based on anonymous sources. And we'll find out which ones to trust. Later, could Ireland's Ryanair be about to buy the beleaguered Italian carrier Alitalia? Plus, the author behind a thriller based on the tiny band of people trying to free hostages.
I spoke to many kidnap negotiators. They're actually called technically response consultants. You know, I didn't have that in my mind as a sexy title for the book, so I coined the phrase freedom broker.
Plus, cats in Istanbul, cut price flats in London, and the biggest stories from Asia. All in the next hour on The Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. First of all, though, a quick look at some of the day's other top news stories. The US Senate has narrowly voted to begin debating a new Republican health care bill. It's a major step forward for Donald Trump's attempt to repeal Barack Obama's health care laws. A number of Republicans who'd previously opposed aspects of the plan changed their minds at the last minute. Divisions inside the Republican Party have hampered Mr. Trump's efforts to repeal Obamacare. The U.S. Navy has fired warning shots at an Iranian Revolutionary Guard vessel in the Gulf. American officials say the boat came within 450 feet and ignored radio calls. The Iranian ship stopped after the warning shots were fired, the latest in a series of close encounters between American and Iranian ships in the Gulf. A man who allegedly attacked people with a chainsaw in Switzerland has been arrested. Frank Rassas was detained 40 miles from the scene of the attack in Schaffhausen. The attack on Monday sparked an international manhunt, with Swiss police admitting at one stage that they had no idea where the suspect was. And Libya's opposing governments have agreed to a conditional ceasefire. The UN-backed Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarra and rival Khalifa Haftar met earlier at talks in France. They are trying to end the conflict that exploded following the ousting of Muammar Gaddafi 6 years ago. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily. Now, it should by now be pretty obvious that even Donald Trump's closest friends are only a moment away from becoming his mortal enemies. The latest example is the Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Just 6 months into a job for which he was handpicked by the president, Trump now describes him as very weak. It seems to be nothing more than a blatant attempt to force Sessions to resign. But why? Well, to find out, I'm joined by Monocle's Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg. Sasha, the source of Trump's anger, it seems, was Jeff Sessions recusing himself from any investigations into Russia. But this is not even for Donald Trump, an especially presidential manner of behaving.
No, and to some degree, what's remarkable about it is how transparent he's being about the ways in which this is a purely self-serving agenda, right? I mean, he did the remarkable thing of firing his FBI director, James Comey, a couple months ago. At the time, there was an understanding from the White House that they had to come up with a cover story that was something other than, I don't like the way that he's pushing ahead with this Russia investigation. And they devised this whole, you know, elaborate story about how he handled the Clinton matter last year. In this case, Trump is being absolutely blunt. He has been, as we know from a lot of reporting, privately very critical of Sessions. You know, his telling of the history is a little dishonest. There, on January 20th, when he took office, there wasn't known to be an investigation for that would require the Attorney General to recuse himself. So that there. he's sort of suggesting that Sessions should have had more foresight than he ought to have. But what's remarkable here, I think, is just that Trump seems to be setting the stage for possibly even a bigger conflict than this one with Sessions, which would be over, you know, trying to remove Bob Mueller as the investigator overseeing this investigation into the Russia matter.
Well, this is what it all feels like it's building towards, like this growing outrage he has at being under investigation. But even some of the people closest to Donald Trump have been saying, you really need to stop bullying Jeff Sessions. It's a bit beneath the office that you're occupying.
Yeah, and this sort of works on two separate levels. I think that there is totally that the idea that it's undignified, it's irresponsible, it's not even like, it's might be self-serving as for Donald Trump, somebody who's the the subject of an investigation. It's not terribly self-serving in that this is one of the highest-ranking cabinet officials who is supposed to be advancing the president's policy, and he's out saying that he's weak and questioning his judgment. Right off the bat, that's unusual. But also, Sessions is incredibly popular among the types of people who have been Trump's most stalwart defenders otherwise. The sort of hard right, and that's both the conservative media, Fox News, Breitbart, talk radio, love Sessions. Sessions is the guy who's basically, you know, spearheading the aggressive immigration policy of this administration. He's the one whose department is defending the Muslim ban that will go before the Supreme Court this fall. And so Trump is sort of torn in this case between the people who are the sort of most hardline in their affinity for sort of Trump's personality, and are also the ones who have the greatest sense of investment in Sessions being able to stay there and do his job. And so he risks sort of putting a wedge within his own coalition in this. Sessions is not somebody, Democrats are put in this odd position where they're rooting for him to stay, but they vehemently oppose him on policy, and many Republicans have precisely the opposite.
Let's say that Jeff Sessions takes the fairly obvious hints and at some stage resigns. Who on earth would be willing to take over that job with a boss like that who, when he's had enough of you, which could easily be by the end of the week, is going to just bully you on Twitter until you resign?
So there are two questions there, right? There's who would take the job, and there are enough people who are sort of Trump cronies who, you know, have a law degree and some legal experience and would probably jump at the opportunity to take the highest law enforcement job in the country, even if they have a premonition that it will not end well. But that person still needs to be confirmed by the Senate. And, this is Jeff Sessions is a former senator. He is held in high regard by many of his Republican colleagues. This is the type of trampling on institutions and just kind of disrespect for one of their own that irks a lot of senators. As we have seen with the difficulty of the healthcare vote, Trump does not have that many Republicans. He can lose on any one vote. And it is hard to envision that the type of person who, the sort of Trump loyalist, whom Trump would want to pick in this situation and who might be willing to expose him or herself to the ridicule that comes along with it, would be the type of person who could hold together all but two Republican votes or get Democratic votes to be confirmed. And you imagine that the price that somebody will have to pay in their confirmation hearings will be to do everything to distance themselves from Trump, much as the new FBI director Chris Wray did in his. And so I think that's the challenge for Trump, and that's what people who are trying to give Trump good advice are telling him now is you might get rid of Sessions either by firing him or driving him out, but you might not get something better at the end of it.
As if he's not in enough trouble with the Russia investigation, now the Senate's demanded that Paul Manafort give evidence to them tomorrow, which he doesn't seem terribly keen to do. Wouldn't Donald Trump be better advised to just, as you say, take his foot off the pedal a little bit and maybe a period of silence might help him?
Yes, and I think that we could say that about a whole lot of things. You know, this is one place where Trump's id is governing his response. There's no obvious strategy here. You know, there was a lot made in the last couple of weeks of bringing a lawyer inside the White House counsel's office to work on this matter. We see no evidence that that this is the type of thing that reflects what a lawyer would tell a client to do. There's a new White House communications director. This does not seem like a savvy communication strategy. This is Donald Trump acting out in some personal pique. If there is a strategy, it is to set the conditions whereby he can remove the special counsel who's investigating him, which is the type of matter that, gets us pretty close to justifying the term constitutional crisis. One of the few things he could probably do that would begin to provoke Republicans who've stood by him in all this to see this as sort of rampant obstruction of justice. So either Trump's playing a very long game and wants to go to the Supreme Court over whether the president's entitled to fire somebody who's investigating him, or he is doing what we often see him doing, which is sort of satisfying his grievance of the hour in ways that do not help his cause in the long run.
Sasha, thanks very much. That's Monocle's Sasha Eisenberg joining us there from Washington, D.C. And a little bit later in the program, we'll be looking at how best to interpret stories based on anonymous sources, so many of which have come out of D.C. You're listening to Monocle 24. Well, next on the Monocle Daily, we turn our attention to aviation and specifically the continuing saga of Alitalia. Well, now the budget carrier Ryanair says it's made a non-binding offer for the airline, which is either facing sale, significant restructuring, or winding up. Well, on the line is Monocle contributing editor and transport expert Tristan McAllister. Tristan, Ryanair and Alitalia don't necessarily feel like a natural fit. Why are they so interested?
Well, I think the biggest thing here is that you're looking at a lot of potential landing slots and air routes that Ryanair would indeed be entitled to were it to take over Alitalia. You have to remember that Ryanair is always looking for more inroads to gain more traction, frankly, in continental Europe with its low-cost carrier model. Much of the business done in Italy in terms of aviation, commercial aviation, is done indeed by Ryanair. They just want more rights to fly more people to and from Italy. You have to think, just looking at this from a very sort of a basic perspective, that Ryanair is really only truly interested in those short-haul routes, within Europe, not necessarily the long-haul routes, which could indeed be sold off take control of Alitalia.
And presumably the Italian government is well aware of what sort of organization Ryanair is and the view it would have of the resources it will be buying from Alitalia.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things here that's interesting in this piece of news, is we've seen that everything was essentially put on the table with potential buyers. We have to remember that, just a few years ago, Etihad came out of Abu Dhabi. Their holding group said, we want 49% of this airline. We think we can turn it around, make it great again. Well, frankly, they failed. The airline's not doing well. They didn't get the concessions from labor that they wanted. They didn't get essentially that institutional buy-in that they thought they could get it. Apparently, it's just been a real rock fight and battle to get the airline anywhere close to being profitable. Ryanair is well aware of this. All the other bidders, all the other organizations that have put offers on the table are surely aware of this as well. Apparently, some even walked away after they saw the numbers. It's very clear here what Ryanair could be walking into, but again, I think the big thing is they feel that these routes that they would be entitled to, especially across Europe from Italy, would be highly valuable to them, and ultimately, they just don't want some other carrier to get them.
Well, exactly. In terms of other carriers, what will Ryanair's competitors make of this?
Well, of course, I have to wonder what the folks at Norwegian and also the folks at EasyJet are thinking tonight. Obviously, the low-cost issue in Europe has been a big thing in terms of taking on the major legacy carriers. But also, when we think about what happened with Brexit or what could happen with Brexit, all of the uncertainty in the market, having more real estate, as it were, in continental Europe is a big important thing for any of these low-cost carriers, especially the ones that have big parts of the market, say in the United Kingdom, where there's a lot of uncertainty, to diversify as much as they can and to take routes in Europe and have more opportunities to fly people within Europe in the EU is very important for them. So I have to imagine that the other low-cost carriers are watching this very closely.
If Ryanair are running a slide rule over Alitalia and considering buying it for whatever their own reasons would be. There must be others who are making similar calculations.
Yes, of course. I mean, there have to be. And I would be curious to know who the bidders are. We haven't seen, at least I've not been able to see who they are. We know this piece of news because, frankly, the chief executive at Ryanair, Michael O'Leary, has been very, very outspoken about the fact that they indeed are sort of in the running for this this opportunity. You know, it could be a number of people that, you know, maybe other airlines, but it could be holding groups. You know, the market for aviation in Europe is ever-changing. Ownership laws make it pretty complicated as to who can actually buy it. So we know that at least in terms of majority ownership, which is what this would be, 51% is at stake. It has to be an organization or an entity within the European Union.
Now, Ryanair has said it's only interested if the Italian government would guarantee that it wouldn't interfere. And while the Italian government might be delighted to get it off its hands, it is the national airline. There is a sort of a reputational issue there for Italy as a country. If a budget airline can come in, buy your national carrier, gut it, it doesn't look good.
Yeah, it doesn't look good. But I think at this point, the saga just needs to end. You know, I think there were a lot of people who thought that Alitalia could indeed recover. I mean, it had an iconic livery designed by Massimo Vignelli. It was, you know, it was sort of one of those great flag carriers of the world. And I think Etihad saw a lot of potential there. They dumped a lot of money into what they thought were good organizational changes and also into the branding and marketing. And they were like, we can make this airline great again. You know, sure, there's a lot of national pride wrapped up in it, but right at this point, the noose around the neck of Alitalia is labor and the fact that concessions just are not being made on the part of those who are running the airline every day, those who are on the front lines, and for good reason. Obviously, you know, they need their pensions and they need to be paid fairly and all of these things, but cost overruns, inefficiencies in the model, and frankly, the low-cost model that has proliferated across Europe, the Ryanairs of the world, the EasyJets of the world, they're a big part of the reason why Alitalia is in the situation that it's in.
Tristan, thanks very much. That's Tristan McAllister on the future of Alitalia. You're listening to Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
What comes to mind when you think about Beirut? Edgy young designers and vibrant ready-to-wear collections might not spring to mind. Monocle Films delves into the fashion scene in Lebanon and meets the new talent in this melting pot of a city.
We've had a lot of difficulty here in Lebanon. We can't seem to unify and to improve ourselves. And this is because of the diversity of cultures that we have. I created a collection that was called Phoenix. And it was a kind of a message from me. We can be together and we can improve together.
Monocle's latest film on fashion is now available to watch on monocle.com.
Now, how much of the various claims that are swirling around the Trump administration would have come to light were it not for anonymous sources? They are at the center of many stories, but can we necessarily trust all of them? Well, the US website 538 has put together a guide for readers to pick through stories that rely on those anonymous sources. And to help us go through it, I'm joined from our bureau in New York by Pete Vernon, who's Delacorte Fellow at the Columbia Journalism Review. Thank you very much for your time today. This guide sets a few good rules to assess the reliability of a story. And one of the ones that leaps out at you is the number of sources. In other words, the more sources, albeit anonymous, the better.
Right. Yeah, I think the gold standard for this was set just after President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. The Washington Post, in their inside report, had a story based on the accounts of more than 30 officials. So when you see a number like that, maybe not everybody's going to get to 30, but if you can get half a dozen or four sources, that certainly beats a story based on one anonymous source.
Then again, I suppose Watergate started with you know, not that many sources.
Sure, right. Right. If your source is Mark Felt, or, you know, an assistant director at the FBI, then I guess the quality of the source can matter also.
And that's the other thing, isn't it? The terms that are used in the article to describe the source. There's a difference between saying senior official in the Justice Department and U.S. government official.
Right. Right. A person familiar with the matter doesn't carry quite the weight that a senior advisor to the president or something like that does.
It's important, presumably, also where the story appears, because there is obviously a certain weight that comes with it appearing in, say, the New York Times, the Washington Post. If it's a website that has a less reliable history of making predictions that don't then come to pass, citing anonymous sources, that's another red light.
Right. I mean, if you have the institutional weight of the Washington Post or the New York Times or NBC News behind you, that's a big deal. I think media literacy for the audience is important, too, to understand that these anonymous sources aren't actually anonymous to the reporters and editors at these places. They know who they are. There's an old editor at the Washington Post who refers to them as confidential sources, not anonymous, because their identities are known.
But there's a thing. Do journalists need to do a bit more to explain to their audiences why they're willing to rely on an anonymous source, why the audience should believe them?
I think that's an important part of this, especially when you have the president attacking the use of anonymous sources and the idea of leakers. For journalists to be as transparent as possible, obviously they can't name or provide identifying information about who these sources are, but to make those judgments a little clearer to the audience is really important, to identify as much as they can or to explain why that person has been granted anonymity is a good first step.
Are we, though, perhaps a little too reliant on anonymity? Are we a little too ready to accept anonymous information?
It's a tough question. Yeah, and it's one that journalists have been debating certainly before Trump came to office. Margaret Sullivan, who was the former public editor at the New York Times, wrote on this extensively when she was there trying to crack down on the use of anonymous sources at that paper. And sometimes journalists probably do give a little bit too much leeway to someone, you know, whether it's in politics or any other field, to allow them to speak behind the cloak of anonymity. That's something most journalists try and get people to do, is go on the record. Sometimes, though, it's, you mentioned Watergate, it's just not possible to get that done.
You mentioned also that the risk to the reputation, I suppose, of the organizations if they get a story wrong. And certainly there's an issue in reporting British politics that anonymous sources will be used, effectively using the journalist to brief against whichever politician your anonymous source is trying to do down. There isn't necessarily a story there. They're just trying to damage somebody else through you.
Right. We've seen this with the different factions in the Trump White House. You have an anonymous source who's close to, say, Steve Bannon saying bad things about Jared Kushner, and vice versa. And we saw the damage that can be done to an organization's reputation when CNN based a report on one single anonymous source in a story that later had to be retracted and resulted in the firing or the resignation of three journalists at that organization.
If you are the organization that is having people endlessly briefing anonymously about you, if, for example, you are the new communications director at the White House, what can you possibly do to stop it?
Well, apparently he's decided he's going to fire everybody until they stop. I'm doubtful that that will be successful. But I think building a culture of trust and as much transparency as possible is perhaps the best defense against your own people deciding that they need to leak information. And this White House is unique in the fact that there are so many leaks and so many people willing and eager to speak with reporters without identifying themselves in order to get their version of what's going on out there.
I suppose another problem with verifying some of the more outlandish anonymous claims that a journalist might get is that some of the truths that are emerging from the White House are so spectacular themselves, you'd have to hear something pretty extraordinary to think, it couldn't possibly be true.
Right. It seems like we've entered an era when pretty much anything is believable, which means it's even more important for journalists to make sure that they have confirmation that there's either a source they trust explicitly or that they have multiple versions of that truth they're reporting. Because right now it seems like there are so many possibilities swirling around infighting in the administration or connections with Russia that it is tough to separate what is fantastical and what might be true, but somewhat unbelievable to those of us that have been following American politics for a number of years.
Pete Vernon, thank you very much. Pete is from the Columbia Journalism Review, helping us with that guide to anonymous sources published by the 538 website. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, this week's edition of The Cinema Show examines things that haunt the city, from the zombies of George Romero's legendary films to, in this case, Cats. Now, as anyone who's visited Istanbul will be able to tell you, Cats hold a rather special place in that city, and the new documentary Kedi examines the fascinating role that Istanbul's cats play in the city's culture. In a preview for the new cinema show, here's Monocle's Ben Rylan speaking to the film's director, Kedi Turan.
For those who have never been to Istanbul, I should clarify that cats are native to the geography of Turkey and to Istanbul and have been around and are around as naturally as any other creature. It's hard to explain because we often think of cats as something that we have brought to life and that are only meaningful with our own existence, but they've in fact been around a long time. And you could argue that they've been in Istanbul as long as humans have been in Istanbul. And the fact that they are very unique there because they grow up with people all around them and they're not owned by any specific people, they behave as if they've known you for a very long time, even if you're a stranger. So the relationship is really poignant and meaningful, even if it is very short-lived.
And that's not just a relationship between the people of Istanbul and the cats. It's in a relationship that we can't really know much about because we can't really have a conversation with cats, but the cats seem to have a relationship with their own city as well.
Absolutely. And I do feel that they represent the timelessness of the city. And I always think, you know, it's very difficult to imagine for us anything that's older than 50 years or 100 years. We're limited in the way we think about time. But these animals, they really have seen all the difficulties the city has endured through the 7,000 years that people have been living there. So in a way, they have a relationship with the city that is older than even what we as individuals feel because they've evolved there. Many of them are descendants of cats that were there thousands of years ago. So their relationship is different. They go in and out of places that we cannot go to. You know, nothing is forbidden to them. Nothing is truly off limits to them. They can access almost anywhere. That's what, you know, excited me about following them around because they also revealed parts of the city that I had forgotten to look at or I had never known. There are these tiny holes on the staircases leading into these old buildings in Beyoğlu and Galata areas. And I didn't know until I paid attention to those holes and then asked about why they were there, that they were actually ventilation holes for the hammams that used to be the communal hammams of everybody in that building, you know, 150, 200 years ago when there was no plumbing. So it's very interesting the things that get revealed when you follow an animal that is native to a city around.
I think cats have sort of become this symbol for the burgeoning use of online videos. They have really helped the concept of watching short videos when you've got a few minutes. That's sort of become a bit of a phenomenon in itself. But that's all about the short and sweet part of consuming cat videos. Was there something that made you look at just the everyday unspoken life of a cat and made you think, I could actually make a full-length film about this? There's so much to this. Was there maybe a particular experience or can you think of a particular sort of observation that you made that gave you this the confidence to proceed with this idea?
Well, I was lucky enough to have been born and raised in Istanbul and had my childhood mostly in the backyard of our apartment building with cats. Being a child and having the time to actually spend the whole day with them or follow them around for good long periods of time, I was able to see that they had whole worlds to them. And the humans were coming in and out of their lives, including myself, but they had full, colorful lives. And when we left the country as a family and started to live elsewhere, I noticed how little people seemed to know about cats. For example, you know, the fact that they seek out, like pregnant cats in Istanbul, will seek out a home to give birth in. And I have many friends who have stories about how they come home from work and they left the balcony door open, and now they have a litter of kittens on their couch, which can be horrifying for some people, but it's genuinely a very pleasant experience. Or the fact that the cats like to disappear to die. They don't like to die in front of you. They go out in hiding, and that's when you know that that's when they're choosing to move on. So these are the kinds of things that when I realized that other people didn't know about these things, I wondered what else there was. And I thought at first, in fact, that we could just solely concentrate on the cats. We could just make a movie kind of like A March of the Penguins and, you know, follow multiple cats, but only their lives. And of course, you know, March of the Penguins or any of those admirable sort of Planet Earth type documentaries require a lot of time and very big budgets, which we didn't have. And while we were doing our research about what the cats did, which is, of course, not as phenomenal as what the Arctic penguins do, but we also realized that the significance of the relationship between the humans and the cats in the city was very, very telling of what we need as human beings.
There's one moment in your film where someone remarks that knowing a cat is a little bit like knowing an alien. I have a cat. In fact, I have a kitten who's only about 10 weeks old. And already I feel the exact same way. Thankfully, a friendly alien, not one that seems to be seeking out to destroy the human race. Not yet, anyway. Still early days. What do you think that observation, that knowing a cat is like knowing an alien, what do you think that is speaking to?
There seems to be a very rewarding and fulfilling experience of communicating with a nonverbal, non-human being. And we don't often get to do that in our lives. I love all animals, but not all animals have the same kind of relationship to us as cats do. We often have classified other animals as work animals or the animals we eat or animals we, you know, consider pests and want to control out of our lives. And cats are pretty much the only animal that we've manipulated very little. We haven't even officially tamed them or domesticated them. And we have this ability to coexist with them. And anyone who has a cat in their lives also knows, like you said, there are moments where they stare at you for long periods of time without wanting anything, which can be unnerving for some people. But in fact, it's one way that they're communicating with us, and it almost feels like they know something. And I think in many ways it speaks to our need to be recognized and validated for our existence. And I think this whole idea of the alien comparison is around that idea that there are other ways to communicate and other ways to form relationships with the world around us. And in fact, we really often need it.
Sarah Turan speaking there to Ben Ryland. That new documentary, Kitty, is now showing. It's part of the new edition of The Cinema Show. You can hear it in full at 20:00 London time tomorrow, when you'll also be able to hear from the director of the new tense Australian crime thriller, Hounds of Love. Well, next we turn to London's housing market, where one startup has developed a solution to get priced out young professionals onto the property ladder. The product is a compact, well-designed flat sold for at least 20% less than the local market rate. It's called Pocket. Their founder, Mark Vlessing, talked to Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli all about it.
So I would say the property industry is actually a very generous industry. Maybe because...
Now that you're in it.
No, maybe because it's so difficult for outsiders to make their way in it. It's such a rarity that outsiders... I mean, most of these guys come from families of property developers.
Right.
So their fascination and their support was great. And they were very generous. The chief executive of one of the largest housing companies in the UK once said that I succeeded with Pocket because I knew nothing. And then he very nicely said, but he did know the one question to ask that nobody was asking, which was, where was Generation Rent going to be living in their early 30s when they wanted to get on the housing ladder?
Because that is a business opportunity.
That is completely the business opportunity.
And yet people, all these people out there, they need a house. Obviously, you can't give them a house for free. They have to spend something, but, you know, they need a house. That's an opportunity.
So we created an entirely new form of affordable housing, a compact home that was income restricted to people who earned less than a certain household income, which was then settled in the annual plan of the Mayor of London, his spatial plan. Nobody had ever done that before because the development community didn't think of affordable housing as a market opportunity at all. They saw it as a painful tax on their open market housing. They had to build affordable housing as part of getting consent. So for them, affordable housing was a pain in the neck. And
because they made no money off of it at all.
No, you have to build this social housing and sell it on to a preferred housing association of the local authority at cost. You can't make a profit on it. They tend to be quite large units. And the private development community tends to think that these homes bring down the prices of the market units. I think there are ways of doing it where that is not the case, but that's certainly their attitude towards it. And so, you know, we've always been very clear that we consider that civil society should subsidize social housing at deep discounts for people in housing need. And, you know, my reckoning is that a decent world city needs about 20 to 30% of its housing as social housing. That's great. That's state-funded housing. But after that point, you do need to come up with public-private partnerships to meet the next bit of affordability need. And that's where we focused. There was a famous Canadian ice hockey trainer, not a sport that I'm in the slightest bit interested in, incidentally, but this quote I did remember, who once said that the greatest ice hockey player was not the guy who got to the puck first, but was the guy who got to where the puck was going to be. And I think that's what happened with Pocket. We asked ourselves a monumentally large question. How large was this group of people who were never going to get their foot on the first rung of the housing ladder and therefore were never going to be able to trade up housing equity? How large was that group going to be? How important were they going to be to the economic and social welfare of London? And therefore, at what point were the politicians going to wake up to the fact that they had an electoral problem if they didn't sort this out?
So your solution was compact houses, well-designed, priced at 20% cheaper than the local market rate.
Correct.
Only available to local first-time buyers who earn below a certain amount.
Yeah.
So first of all, the homes themselves, when you launched, and correct me if I'm wrong if it's still not this, but 38 square meters. And at the time you launched, that was below what the minimum requirement for what was considered a house would be.
Yeah.
So why did you choose that, and how did you kind of get around breaking down that precedent?
When you know nothing, you work off different principles. So I never looked at planning policy. I asked myself some very basic ergonomic questions, and then I overlaid the economic realities. At the time, the space standard for one-bedroom homes was 49 square meters, and it was clear that, you know, 500 square feet, 49 square meters, was not affordable to people on median incomes in London. So put it in today's terms, the median income of a London household today is just over 35,000 pounds. The average first-time buyer flat in London today is 330,000 pounds. So it's absolutely clear that the median income cannot get to that average first-time buyer price. By how much do you have to discount that in order to make it just about imaginable, maybe with some help from their parents, that median income could get on the housing ladder? And we reckon that if you could discount it by 20%, so you bring that price point down to 40 to 50, which is indeed where we are today with Pocket across London as an average, that we could price somewhere around 50 to 60% of the cohort of working 20 to 39-year-olds currently priced out into home ownership. Well, there are 1.7 million 20 to 39-year-olds working in London today. So that's a massive big market. We then worked backwards and said, okay, what can you build for that? Construction costs are what they are, whether you're building Grosvenor Square or the north of Enfield. What was planning policy forcing you to do? Oh, it was forcing you to do very large flats, 49 square meters.
And where did that number come from, 49?
That was just what planning...
threw a dart at a board and...
Well, we came out of a culture of having had very generous social housing space standards. There was a study done by somebody called Parker Morris. And that was done on the principle that people who had no choice in life, who were probably going to be living in these homes for all their lives, should be given as generous a space as was possible.
And Fair enough.
I have a lot of sympathy with that. But we're dealing with people who still have some choice and who can trade once you give them that first rung, that they could put their first boot on. So we worked backwards and said, well, 49 square meters, wherever we look in London, we can't even make it affordable in Zone 6. And anyway, our group doesn't want to live in Zone 6. What they want Pocket to do is to get them out of Zone 6 into Zone 2 and 3. They're realistic that we're never going to be able to create something that's affordable for them on Grosvenor Square, but can we make something affordable for them in Kentish Town? Can we make something affordable for them in Hackney? It was always the case that we were going to have to bring them towards sort of Zone 2 and 3, and then there was a really fascinating moment where Rem Koolhaas, and maybe my Dutch links there were helpful, did a study on the psychological impacts of living in compact spaces for the National Architectural Institute in Rotterdam. And I got hold of it and talked to him and people in his environment about, you know, the key drivers. And they all seemed very sensible to me. We'd sort of already started to develop these drivers. They were design drivers. You know, you can live in a compact space, you need to give people supercharged big windows so that you maximize daylight. You need to give them lots of storage. They have lots of cupboard space. You need to give them lots of cycle provision. You need to give them roof terraces or courtyards that they can engage with the outside world in, because the flats are quite compact. You need to be able to have a full-size Super King bed in the bedroom, a wardrobe and a desk. But then that's it. Once you've done that, you don't need any more in there, because actually you want to maximize the living space. And you have to think like boat builders. So our kitchens have all kinds of nooks and crannies and drawers that come out of nowhere. But it's not expensive. It's not gadgety. You know, one of the problems with what's going on in New York often is that they put a hugely expensive movable furniture into these spaces. And they say, you know, this is a compact space. We've made it affordable, but the furniture costs $300,000.
Or movable walls themselves.
None of that stuff makes sense to me. You need to be able to go to IKEA and buy a normal sofa and be able to fit it in. So when we did all that working backwards of what can you buy construction-wise, what can you buy land-wise, what does it take to be able to get in a full-size bed and a full-size sofa, and how do you get a really efficient circulation space so that you don't have long corridors, because nobody can do anything with corridors. So you need your front door towards the middle of your flat so that you have the smallest amount of circulation space to get to the three doors you need to get to, the bathroom, the bedroom, and the living room space. That came out at 400 square feet. And so it literally was working backwards. And what I'm really, you know, delighted about is that 12 years later, you go into a pocket flat and you compare the pocket flat today to the one that we did 12 years ago. And spatially, it's the same.
And that was Mark Vlessing, who is the founder of the property firm Pocket, talking to Daniel Giacopelli. You can hear more in the full edition of The Entrepreneurs tomorrow at 1900 London time.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Now, all this week here on Monocle 24, we are delving into the pages of the new edition of The Escapist. And today, we can hear from Monocle's Vienna correspondent, Kimberly Bradley, who tells us about her fondness for night trains.
I'll never forget my first time. It was a balmy midsummer night, and I prickled with excitement. I was young, about to sleep with strangers and wake up somewhere I'd never been before. It was my first night train. The route from Hamburg-Altona to Stockholm saw me through Germany and Denmark, waking up in a compartment with Canadian travel companions watching the sunrise over birch forests in southern Sweden. Across the world, the night train has a long history. Pullmans were huge in 19th century America, and the luxury of the Orient Express of yore is legendary. More recently, European sleepers have been synonymous with adventure. For young Eurailers, the night train has represented a rite of passage and sometimes an all-night party. Even so, passenger numbers in Europe are falling. There were rumblings that it would soon all be over, and sure enough, in December 2016, Germany's Deutsche Bahn, its national rail service, put the brakes on all of its night routes. Luckily, Austria has rolled in to save the night. Its national rail service, the ÖBB, whose night jet trains already ran along 9 overnight routes, picked up the routes that Deutsche Bahn dropped. The market was apparently too small for the Germans, but for the Austrians it made perfect sense. I recently took the sleeper to Venice, and as I waited on the platform in Vienna, I felt a familiar anticipation. Since my Hamburg-Stockholm adventure so long ago, I've spent nights in first class with my daughter, who is thrilled to try the top bunk. I've shared a nighttime compartment with an art dealer and 40 paintings. There was even a Chinese journey between Chengdu and Lhasa, and I woke up to the sight of a yak herder on the Himalayan plateau. No matter how experienced you are, and no matter how little sleep you get, riding the rails through the wee hours is still a thrill. For Monocle, in Vienna, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
And that new issue of The Escapist is on newsstands now. Well, time now to take a look at some of the news stories making headlines across Asia. My guest in the studio tonight is Ramon Pesce-Capado, who's a senior lecturer in international relations at King's College London. Thank you very much for coming in this evening. Let's start with South Korea, where the government is hoping to find some new ways to boost the economy.
Yes, actually wants to increase public spending, which in South Korea traditionally has been lower than in other developed countries. And it also wants to boost employment in the small and medium-sized enterprises, not only in the big chains like Samsung and LG that we all know about.
To what extent is South Korea's economy sort of too reliant on those really big companies?
It is heavily reliant. I mean, some reports say that over half of the economy is relying on these big chains, especially on Samsung, actually, which is very dominant inside the country. And this is what the current government wants to change. It wants other smaller companies that we don't know about outside of Korea to actually give a boost to economic growth and jobs in the country.
And as you say, it's quite a change for the government to say we're going to increase public spending.
Yes, it is a big change. They want to increase the spending, for example, in unemployment benefits, support for small, medium-sized enterprises, if they create permanent jobs, for example. They also want to help foreign companies that want to establish themselves in Korea. And this has been tried before, but not to the extent that the current government wants to do.
Let's move on to Hong Kong, because the construction industry struggles a little bit in Hong Kong to attract particularly younger people to take jobs. And there's one company that's found a new way to make itself more appealing.
Yes, before we're talking about the Korean government, now we're talking about Hong Kongese companies. What they're trying to do, they're trying to introduce technology, the digitization, to attract these younger workers that have grown up basically with the internet, with mobile phones, and find this maybe more attractive than just a normal construction job.
So this is working in construction somehow on your phone?
Yes.
Trying to figure out how that works.
It's probably related to that. I mean, there is the training component that will involve, for example, using mobile phone applications and computer programs. But yes, also when you are apparently in a construction site, you will be able to use this technology. So you won't be doing, for example, everything by hand anymore. You can look at the screens, and this can help you actually in the construction of a building.
I presume that fundamentally building does still involve somebody in the end putting bits of a building together.
Yes, and I think this is where the company is struggling, that, I mean, you can try to introduce technology, but every day you have to have someone manually...
You have to build it.
Exactly, yes. And apparently some younger people have been attracted to the training itself, but we don't know whether they will stay, because the training is 1 or 2 years, and then we'll see, maybe after 2 years they decide, well, this is not for them after all.
In Tokyo, finally, it's 3 years now to the 2020 Olympics, and it's a date that they've been marking in the city.
Yes. The 3 years 2020 Games. In East Asia, they're talking about the 6 years of how do you say, of tourism boom, because they have the Winter Olympics in Korea next year, then they have the Tokyo Olympics in 2020, and then we move to 2022 to the Olympics Winter Olympics in Beijing. Now, in the case of Tokyo, it seems they want to revive a song that they had from 1964, Tokyo Gorinondo, Tokyo Olympic Dance. So in 3 years' time, we'll be dancing like Japanese, apparently, around the world.
Now, there were all these conversations a few weeks ago about the upcoming announcement of who's going to host the Olympics in 2024 and 28, and specifically that we already know there's no particular drama because most of the bidding cities have dropped out, because they've come to the conclusion, having looked at London, having looked at Rio, having looked at all these other cities that have hosted it, that you don't make any money out of hosting the Olympics. It costs you billions, and you end up with this huge white elephant in the middle of your city and nothing in particular to show from it. Is there no worry in Tokyo that it's like we've taken on something that's going to cost us a fortune and not deliver anything?
There is. And Shinzo Abe is very popular, but this is one of the areas in which his popularity seems to be dropping, that no one knows what's going to happen after the Olympics. Well, we know what's going to happen, actually, with the stadiums that are being built. They're not going to be very used very often. And he's trying to claim that this time is going to be different, but then all presidents, all mayors say the same. I don't think it's going to be the case. And he's trying to cut costs, but then it is very difficult, right?
And the 1964, you mentioned the 1964 Tokyo Olympics, then it would have been a matter of enormous pride for Japan, less than 20 years after the end of the Second World War, to be hosting the Olympics this time. As you say, it could end up being something that is politically really unpopular to be saddled with
it. Yes, yes. It has to be said, the Olympics per se, they seem to be popular, but everything that surrounds the Olympics, for example, the payments that apparently were made to win the bid, the stadiums that are being built and they are overpriced, that's why they're trying to cut costs, are becoming unpopular. So it seems that Japanese people are still differentiating between the sport and the actual construction that goes with the Olympics and how expensive it is and the whole bidding process. But this is 3 years to go, and if things don't go well, this could become a political problem for the current government.
The key thing is always the mascot. The Olympic mascot must be something that will terrify every child that sees it.
And the dance in the case of Japan, I mean, maybe some sort of Macarena, who knows?
I'm gonna have to look this up now, this Olympic dance, so that I can not learn it and have no part in it, because I'm a middle-aged man and I don't do things like that. Ramon, thank you very much for joining us. Ramon Pacheco-Pardo there with his look through some of the stories from Asia here on Monocle 24. Now, everyone likes a good crime thriller, and that includes KJ Howe, who has just written her debut novel with a female action hero, Thea Paris. KJ is also executive director of Thriller Fest, which is one of the largest thriller and crime book festivals in the world. Well, she met Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco to talk about her novel, The Freedom Broker, as well as Thriller Fest, and why the genre is so popular.
There are over 40,000 reported kidnappings every year across the globe. And sadly, it seems to be an international growing crisis. And I find kidnapping very fascinating because it's a purgatory of sorts. You're alive, but you're not really living. And you're dependent on someone else for absolutely everything you need. So as a result of that, growing up, I lived internationally. My father worked in telecommunications. So I really knew I wanted to do an international thriller. And then kidnapping really grabbed my attention. And as a result, I created an elite kidnap negotiator called Thea Paris. And Thea has a very personal motivation for being a kidnap negotiator. And when she was 8 years old, her 12-year-old brother was snatched in front of her. So I think it was very profound influence, and it really drove her to become what we call a freedom broker. Because of her personal experience, she wanted to save other families the grief that she experienced.
Before we talk more about the book itself, it's fascinating. First of all, Thea is a woman, you know, in an industry with such a male-heavy protagonist. I think people were tired of that. Did you think about that when you're writing the book?
Well, I've always been adventurous. I had two brothers growing up. I learned to motorcycle, scuba dive, and do all sorts of sports. So for me, I knew I wanted to write a strong female character. Also, we have Jason Bourne, James Bond. We need some estrogen in this world, right? Especially with Wonder Woman and Atomic Blonde and other movies coming out. I think the book world is kind of catching up, and I'm really hoping that Thea will speak to the young girls out there.
I was already imagining Thea being portrayed by Charlize Theron as the main character.
Okay.
Who knows?
Fingers crossed, right?
Yes, absolutely. And tell me about the research you've done for the book as well, because I know you spoke to so many people about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's many different aspects of research that I completed, and one of which I spoke to many kidnapped negotiators. You know, they're actually called technically response consultants, but that's not, you know, I didn't have that in my mind as a sexy title for the book. So I coined the phrase freedom broker. And actually a lot of these response consultants love it so much, they're adopting it, saying, oh, I'm a freedom broker. So that's been wonderful. And I've also interviewed a lot of former hostages, specifically Peter Moore. He was the longest held hostage in Iraq, almost 1,000 days. And what he went through and what he, you know, how he was able to survive for all that length of time really touched my heart. And so I really dove into that with him psychologically to understand what he did to survive. In addition to that, I've also spoken to psychiatrists who specialize in the hostage's mindset to understand what goes on when you're in captivity, and as well to reintegration specialists. And they help hostages get back into normal life after they come back. And also for the fight scenes, I did a couple of different things. One of which, I went to the Phoenix Desert and I did some combat training. So hand-to-hand, you know, firearms and knife fighting. And that was a wonderful experience and definitely gave me a little more confidence. And I had these special forces people read my book and the action scenes specifically, just to make sure I had all the concepts right and, you know, really didn't make any silly errors.
But tell us, of course, it's a crime thriller book as well, but your involvement with the genre, you know, it's not new as well, because you also work with, you know, Thriller Fest.
And I welcome absolutely everyone to join me at Thriller Fest.
Tell us a bit more about, for sure, those who don't know about what's a Thriller Fest, yeah, and when does it happen?
Delighted to, because it's a really exciting event. And if you're a thriller enthusiast, it's a place to be. It's like I can tell you. Every July in Manhattan, in New York, at the Grand Hyatt Hotel, we host a week-long conference. And during that conference, we have some of the top thriller writers from all over the world descend on New York and join us. So it's pretty fantastic to be able to walk down the halls and you see Peter James and Lee Child and Steve Barry and David Morrell, who created Rambo. And you'll just be able to talk to them at length. You know, it's a very friendly, informal setting. And if you're an aspiring author, it's a spectacular place to go because we have a lot of craft classes to teach you how to write. And we have this amazing event called Pitch Fest, which I affectionately named the zoo. And that is over 60 agents are there, and the aspiring authors can pitch to them in like a speed dating format.
For a future, you know, thriller crime author, what would be your advice to them? Because, you know, I know sometimes it might be a crowded market, but at the same time, people love it. I mean, they're always on the bestsellers lists, and I think it's something people don't get tired of.
I couldn't agree more, and I believe that if you have a passion for crime fiction, there's a place for you. You just have to be dedicated and have a lot of perseverance. You know, my best advice would be to embrace criticism from credible sources. I've taken a lot of retreats, for example, in the Bahamas. I studied with Lee Child. And, you know, having that one-on-one connection and having him ask me some, you know, great questions and how I can and learn how I can improve my plot or my writing, it was just an incredible experience. I feel very much that you need to choose something, a topic that you're incredibly passionate about. And I'm sure you can tell that I'm very passionate about kidnapping. And I was very lucky to get a 2-book deal. So I will definitely keep writing about this. And that's another thing that I think people should think about as aspiring authors. Publishers really like series because if someone discovers you in the fourth book, they can just go and read your backlist, right? So it's a great setup to fall in love with a group of characters and just keep reading the stories about them.
I was about to ask if there will be a Freedom Broker 2 in some ways.
Yes.
Do you have a date?
My second novel in the series, Skyjack, will be coming out. And I bet you can guess what that story entails.
You know, I want to ask about Thriller Fest as well. Of course, you attract people from all around the world. Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot of people from other states in the U.S. as well. What are the major markets for this type of genre? Do you think it's fairly equal all around, or are there particular countries that are quite interested?
The U.S. is the largest thriller market by far because of the population alone. And I guess their fascination, you know, with crime. And second to that is actually the UK. You know, right behind those two are France and Germany. So that's kind of the, you know, way it lands. But we have publications, for example, I came out in Poland, like, you know, not too long ago. So it's just pretty fantastic to have the opportunity to reach international, you know, readers of crime fiction.
And that's KJ Howe speaking there to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And her book, The Freedom Broker, is out now. It is published by Headline. And that's it for this edition of The Monocle Daily. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researchers Guy Lutz and Hunter Sharp, and our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. 8 hours from now, it's The Globalist. Tige Enright will be sitting in this chair in just a moment after the news headlines. Chiara Lamella has more music for you from The Monocle playlist on The Pacific Shift. But that's it for now. The Monocle Daily back at the same time, 2200 in London tomorrow. From me, though, Paul Osborne, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.